Welcome to Keep the Hotel Empty. Today we've kept the hotel empty for owner-operator of Sarasota's premier coffee company, O&A Coffee, Mr. Justin Bannister. Justin, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, excited to be here.
Oh, man, we're excited to have you. We have had some acts of God and some Florida nature keep keep this one at bay for a minute. I think this is maybe our fourth try, so it's very, very good.
Yeah, one
good
of those was
you.
On me, though. So yeah. That one wasn't an act of God. That was me, what, roasting or something like that, and you guys calling me and going, huh, that was today. Oh, well, my bad. Okay. So, yeah. So one
we
on
get
me.
A mulligan in two weathers.
Yeah.
So I know you got a deep passion for coffee going all the way back to the growers, and I definitely want to talk about how that works into your philosophy of operating your brick and mortar that I know you've had going for just about 6 years now. Mm-hmm. But I want to press rewind because that's kind of how we do it around here and start at the start. Take me back to coffees with your grandpa.
Oh, man. I mean, my grandpa's old school, you know, GI generation. You know, if we went anywhere, he'd always order coffee, black and boiling. That's how he drinks it. And, you know, growing up, you know, he was really a big father figure in my life, pretty much the father figure in my life. And I remember, you know, going over on the weekends, you know, if my grandpa ate three pancakes, I ate three pancakes. If my grandpa drinks coffee, I drink coffee. You know, and that starts back from me being 5 years old. And, you know, my grandmother would make it in an old school percolator. Originally, it was Folgers because I'm from Kansas City. Folgers used to roast in Kansas City.
Oh.
And so he's a big KC guy. And then they moved their he's also a loyalist, you know, that's the old school generation.
Oh,
so, you
of
know,
course.
Folgers moved their roasting facility to Mexico in like the late 80s, I think it was. And it was like they were dead to my grandfather, you know, and no clue what he drank after that, you know. But, you know, that kind of a style of coffee when percolate it, make it. Tar-like, you know, black as night. And, you know, at the time I'd put, you know, 5-6, you know, sugars in there or whatever, because I'm also 5 or 6 years old.
Yeah, it's like the most bitter thing on planet Earth at that point.
Awful, just awful, you know. But that was kind of my introduction really to coffee. And other than my grandfather, no one else in my whole family really drinks coffee. So we were kind of the outliers. And it was like this thing between him and I, you know, whether it be right before a fishing trip early in the morning or just on a Sunday before, you know, doing something at his house or repairing. He's always building something, you know, that's that old generation as they retired, you know.
Right.
So always loved that. And it just was the right way to start your day. It was a ritual.
That's what I was just going to say. So the ritual element plays into it a bunch.
It really does. Yeah. It's why still even today, like, you know, I have the shops and I could easily go into one of my shops and have someone make a coffee, or I can make myself a coffee in the shops. And I still do that, but I still start every single day by making myself a coffee at home. Like, that's when I breathe. That's when I start my day. So it's all about that ritual motion.
So how does this start? I mean, you're 5 years old at this point. You get introduced to the ritual aspect of it. You start to see the camaraderie aspect of it, the social aspect of it. Okay, how does this start to transition as you get older into this is something you're going to do professionally? Because there's a jump between five-year-old and how you get to doing this.
I mean, you want, like, the elevator version or you want, like,
Yeah, we'll pick apart the elevator version. When does it start to hit you that coffee is going to be a bigger part of your life than just the ritual, I guess, is the operative question.
Probably Venezuela. So 1997 in Venezuela. I wasn't always the greatest person in the world. You know, we all go through phases.
Sure.
And my mom kind of saw that, you know, single-parent mom, homeschooled my sister and myself. But still ran a business full time. And, you know, I got involved in some other not great things in the neighborhood and stuff like that. And my mom kind of saw that and she decided she was going to take me, my sister and herself overseas to, like, basically do like a mission trip and, like, you know, go care for other people. And we went to Venezuela for 3.5 weeks in 1997 and spent a lot of time in Medicaid and watched coffee in a Latin culture go from a morning tradition to an afternoon tradition. So it's kind of neat just to even see that aspect where it's now this, you know, siesta time where you're going to chill and have coffee in the afternoon and sip and watch the family dynamic of that around a whole entire culture.
Hmm.
And that really, I don't know, that was something that kind of hit me there, especially, you know, sitting in like rainforests and visiting my first coffee farm.
Right.
And like all of that stuff.
This is sensory overload completely.
Yeah, just, you know, I was 13 years old and that was when I realized, like, I love this. Like, it maybe not, the Black and Boilin, you know,
right.
Like
yeah,
there
yeah,
is,
yeah.
there's a time and a place for a Waffle House coffee,
sure.
you know, and it's at Waffle House.
Right.
Like, but at home drinking something, and that was my first time having black coffee and really going, this is what I want. Like, I haven't put cream and sugar in my coffee since that point.
Dang.
Like, I mean, if you're doing like a latte or whatever, you know, some.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. You know, but if I'm just drinking coffee, I'm drinking coffee. And that started at 13. And that's what I wanted from that point. And that's when, you know, obviously I'm not saying like my palate was developed or anything, but I could taste a difference. And I was like, I want this, you know. And so I started going overseas, obviously not for coffee, but just to go and like help people and stuff like that. And I started doing that every summer from then on.
Awesome.
Starting at 13. And so started going to different countries and experiencing different things and, you know, going to Costa Rica and spent a lot of time in Costa Rica. A lot of areas over there just so saturated with coffee.
And what's some of the big things you were able to take away from those adventures when you didn't have a developed palate, when you were really just green in this,
yeah.
but in such a fertile place to learn things?
So, I mean, it's kind of cool because it's still, you know, just like you said, take it back to grandpa. So growing up in Kansas City, it's a major metropolitan town. It's like a lot of people haven't been there, things like that. It's a big city.
Yeah.
And, but yet my grandfather had probably like a 1/3 acre, 1/2 acre lot, but still pretty close to downtown. And that whole backyard was all just a garden.
Awesome.
So agriculture in just a small scale has always been a part of my life. You know, just going back there and pulling weeds on a Saturday and growing corn and growing asparagus and like all this other stuff, right? It's just always a part of everything that I've done. And so once you start going overseas and you start to see the people that are growing coffee, and you start to see and meet the like the actual owners, you know, and down there, they're not called farmers, they're called producers.
Ah.
So you have a coffee producer because they are producing a product for you, even though they are growing it. And so you start to meet some of these producers and you start to dive in on how, especially the younger generation, the people that are inheriting these farms from their families, that their families didn't have the right channels to actually really make a living. They would have to wait for some big boy to come in, offer them barely any money, and then they would have to sell it for that, you know, whatever conglomerate, like a Nestle or something like that.
Okay.
Because, you know, maybe they're only growing 2 acres worth of coffee. And so the importing channels didn't exist back then. And that was something I kind of learned at a younger age, my teen years, just talking with people. And like at that time, like obviously I didn't want to be in coffee. Like, I don't know what I wanted to do necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
I had been pursuing being a pilot. And so I'd been focusing on that and doing flight school and all that kind of stuff. And really thought that was going to be my entire life. And then, you know, as things kind of progressed, did a bunch of other different things. And really, like, the one constant I've always had as far as, you know, not like counting family or whatever, you know.
Yeah,
but,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
my
yeah.
one constant's been coffee. And so after doing, hell, I've done, you know, carpentry, I've done telecom, I did small business networking solutions, like.
That's some voodoo stuff right there.
Awful, man. If I got to look at a computer screen and sit behind a desk for 12 hours, I'm going to push my face through that computer screen.
Right.
Like, I'm not built for that.
So that was one of the lessons that you took from
yeah.
Costa Rica.
And dude, like I want to be on my feet, you know, and I want to grow something. And obviously, I'm not going to grow coffee. I can't do that here. And so what's the next best thing? And, you know, my mom's always been an entrepreneur. I've always grown up around that. I always started other little companies and all this other stuff as a kid and just, you know, started doing kind of coffee consulting and then worked for the big boy Starbucks for like 4 years. Because, you know, when you need to get into it and the industry doesn't exist, you know, and this was, this would have been 14 years ago, I guess, when I was still working for them. And just wanted to get away from it all and get back to, you know, the roots.
Right.
And, man, there's no good way to do that unless you do it. And so it kind of was the inspiration behind it, I guess.
Well, I want to circle back to that, but one of the things you mentioned is a thing I like to ask people a lot when they make what seems like a hard left.
Mm-hmm.
You had a desire to be a pilot. You had mm-hmm. put time and energy and effort into doing this. You had thought you were going to do it. What's the moment like when you realize maybe I'm not going to do this?
So, man. So there's a really small, I guess restaurant's probably the best word. It's on the side of the Irazu volcano in Costa Rica. And I was eating a skirt steak that's like cooked over banana leaves with some refried black beans and some like fried plantains.
Oh, you're making my mouth water.
Ugh. That's like, you know, everyone has their death row meal. It's like, it's either that one or like ribs from Kansas City. Like it's one of the two, maybe both, you know, like that's my death row meal. And sitting there and drinking a coffee, it's actually funny because now I realize it's like basically trash, but it's like what the Costa Ricans give to the tourists.
Right.
But still, it's better than anything we have like here, especially at the time. You know, this would have been probably, I guess this would have been 2000, 2001. And I was sitting there just overlooking like the rainforest and just sipping this and just, I wanted to be in that and I wanted to be there. And, you know, even in all my time flying and all of that, and like, there's something so freeing about being up in the air.
Right.
You know, it's, you're a freaking bird. Like, that's awesome. But that was probably more freeing than that. And just sitting there in that, you know, hot, humid rainforest, being around the people and everything else was kind of when I started to realize that shift was happening. And I just didn't know how to necessarily get there at the time. And I guess I just spent probably the next, 9-10 years trying to figure out how to go from that point to actually in the coffee industry itself.
Right.
You know,
and that's why I asked that, because those points, you know, they do sometimes open 9 years worth of journey when it seems like this might be a fleeting feeling.
Yeah.
So I'm always curious how that is.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I was still in college at the time, and so I wanted to finish off those degrees and everything else. And,
oh, okay. What kind of degrees were you getting? Stuff for business?
So I did. No, I don't have a single business degree. Not one. It's actually funny. I work in business and I'm basically a chemist. I never took a single class for any of that stuff. So I have a degree in journalism. And if you read or ever look at my handwriting, it's very noticeable that I have a degree in journalism because you sure can't read it.
nice.
Awful chicken scratch. It's garbage.
Journalist first doctors.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And it's shorthand, left hand. Awful.
Nice.
But yeah, so I have a degree in journalism. And then weirdly enough, they wouldn't accept when I transferred any of like the stuff I had taken at community colleges and all that stuff, unless you had a degree. So I was like, I guess I'll get an associate degree. So I have that in film. And then from there, did broadcast. And then my final bachelor's was actually in missions, specializing in third world country agriculture and aquaculture relief efforts.
Awesome.
So yeah, did a lot of different research on aquaculture and like hydroponic growing and like all that kind of stuff too. So,
how did that play into your subsequent meetings with these producers and evaluations of other agriculture?
I mean, there's agriculture's so cool and there's a lot of really neat projects, let alone in other countries as well as even here. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the projects that really inspired me is this really cool project that happened in Detroit. It would have been like 2005, I guess. Mm-hmm. And Detroit's pretty much, you know, was falling out at that point. And it was about to become an abandoned city.
Yeah.
Which is weirdly what St. Louis is going through right now, too, which is crazy. And this dude moved in and bought an old textile building in Detroit where they used to do fabrics and everything else. And he would raise chickens on one floor and he would bust out the flooring and then put like chicken wire down for half of the floors. And so excess chicken feed and chicken waste would fall through the floor to the next floor. And the next floor was just tilapia beds. And so all the tilapias would eat all the chicken waste and all the excess chicken feed. And then they would grow. And then you would have drains in the bottom that would take all the tilapia waste. And then that would then flow down and water the hydroponic farm that was on the next floor.
Wow.
And he's doing this in like a warehouse in Detroit.
Dang.
And so I read that article and kind of was like, why can't we implement this all over the world? And so I had taken a few trips already to like Africa and all that and started working with a few people over there to try to implement that on just like a gravity feed where you could put tilapia below a chicken coop. 'Cause tilapia are crazy. Like In the coffee world, we refer to mutation. So anytime a coffee varietal changes from one type of bean to a new type of bean, which it can do in an environment and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a GMO. It's an actual mutation of the plant. Tilapia literally mutate. They're almost the same. It's crazy. And they can mutate within three generations. So if you put tilapia in the ground, they'll grow and not have eyes within three generations. They'll be blind and they can just exist that way.
That's insane.
It's nuts. And so you can grow in pure darkness. And, you know, in the States, it's just a trash fish. Like, we feed it so much waste. Like, I would never eat U.S. like tilapia.
Right.
But, like, over there, like, you know what you're feeding it. Like, it's still a good fish. It reproduces super fast. And so it did a little bit of work over there and then did a little bit of work in Belize with a place that was already doing tilapia farming. And had, like, a really cool project and was going to literally move to Belize and had sold a bunch of my stuff and shipped a bunch of my stuff already down there. And then some stuff fell through. And, you know, just working with other companies, essentially, or other nonprofits when I was doing that. And learned a lot, but it just never was exactly me or what I wanted to do. And so kind of, you know, at that point, tried to reshift back into, you know, that one thing that's that always been that constant, which is always been coffee.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Okay, so whilst you're doing these things mm-hmm. and it's serious enough to the point where you're thinking about moving to a different country to do it,
mm-hmm.
are you always having that thought in the back of your mind like, man, maybe this isn't for me, but I'm just going to keep going? Does the vision at that cafe over the rainforest, you know, pop up every now and again?
I think so. I mean, I think that's one of... This is an older gentleman I had coffee with when I was living in Lakeland, Florida, that I had never met, and I met him in a cafe.
Mm-hmm.
And he was sitting there, and I always like to talk to the older generation because, well, they know more than us.
Right.
And so I'm chatting with him, just randomly met him sitting at the bar at a coffee shop. And I don't remember what I asked him, but I remember him looking at me and going, "How long have you been alive?" And I was like, you know, at the time I think it was like 19 years old or 20 years old, right? And mm-hmm. he went, "No, that's not the question. When you get to my age, you need to figure out how long you've been alive." And he's like, "If I'm lucky, I've been alive maybe about 5 hours." And he was in his upper 70s. And he's talking about those individual moments where you truly feel alive. And how long does that moment last? And for me, that moment in Costa Rica was always one of those moments.
Mm.
That moment only lasted, what, a minute and a half? You know, when someone's going to talk to me or, I don't know, it's Costa Rica, some monkey's going to yell or whatever, you know, and snap me out of it. Like, that's going to be the case. But that little moment there of that 30, 45 seconds, I was truly alive. And those are the moments that create it. And so ever since I had that conversation with that man, that's always been something that I strive for. And for me, I'm a massive workaholic. So I know that numbers very small. Like, I'm just way too driven on certain things and I forget time to breathe and really have those moments. But when you do, I think it's something that you naturally, your mind's going to drift to. You know, whether it's that you're stuck in traffic and you want to get out, where's your mind going to go?
Right.
Or is it just sitting on my deck at night, you know, chilling, like my mind go there. Like, so I always try to find and create those moments as well as still have some of those moments as well.
Yeah, that's really important insight. Yeah, and you can only get that sort of thing from someone who's walked that mile and can say, hey.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
In hindsight. So eventually, we're not going to be a pilot. We're not going to do the agriculture, nope. But coffee is this constant. So where do you get to the point where coffee is now something you're going to start maybe putting your stuff in a box to move forward towards?
So I worked for left corporate, Starbucks. The job I was even working at the time doesn't exist anymore. It became a computer program, which was me working with them, doing like shift training, but then also doing like tastings and all this other stuff. And that's when I realized how much I love that aspect and the actual like palate and palate control and being able to sip and taste a coffee and break it down and all this stuff.
So when, and I don't mean to deviate here, but where's the point? Is there a day where you're sitting there and you're saying to yourself, I'm just going to get into coffee now, and is Starbucks the place, is corporate where you started?
Pretty much, yeah. Like with an actual real job, yeah, it'd be Starbucks corporate. I was working in telecom before that.
No, I mean, that was the first foray into coffee.
Yeah, I literally walked out of the company I was working at walked over to a Starbucks and went, "Are you hiring?"
Okay, and see, that's the manager, what I'm curious about.
Yeah, the manager looked at me and they're like, "Well, we're in like a hiring freeze, but why? Do you know someone that wants the job?" And I went, "I want to start here in 2 weeks." And she was like, yeah, we'd hire you." And I was like, "Great, that's October 30th, so I'll be here then."
Nice.
And she like froze and didn't know what to say, and I walked out the door. And then I walked back 2 weeks later on October 30th, and I went, "All right, I'm starting."
And this is the beginning of the
journey.
And
that's when I first started in coffee, like actually making a paycheck type thing.
Okay, so let's press the play button from that moment. Yeah, okay.
From that moment, I tend to have a very big personality. Try to rein it back sometimes. And very weirdly, like that manager, I think kind of saw that side of me, and went through the Starbucks ranks very quickly, from just, you know, barista, shifts, blah, 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 all the way up.
Right.
And then the real corporate side kind of came out, because I want to taste. That's what I love. Like, I love tasting and breaking down flavor profiles and all this. And like, I started to realize that's something I truly love. And, you know, food's always been an active part of my life and everything else. So it's a natural progression going on there. I mean, coffee has three times the number of tasting notes of wine. Mm. Like, it's so complex. And, you know, don't tell wine people that because they get really moody about it because they're so more expensive.
Guaranteed.
Cool. You know, guaranteed. But like,
that's a line in the sand right
absolutely,
there.
Absolutely. Yeah. I love saying it to them and just messing with them.
Yeah.
But, you know, and so going into that, I loved that. And corporate wants you to do something. That's what corporate is. And I get that. And so they wanted me to start taking over stores. I don't want to be a store manager at Starbucks. And I was like, I don't want to do that. This is what I want to do. Well, corporate's not used to you saying no.
Right.
So if you say no to them, what do?
Show you the door.
They punish you.
Yeah.
And so I got shipped around to different shops that were failing.
Yeah, they always got to tell you, be careful of getting good at something you don't want to do.
That's right. And I became this, like, pretty mean manager that was, like, the guy that would fire everybody. And did not like who I became.
Right.
To the point that actually I was in Venice, Florida, I guess with hurricane time frame, probably realistically was like 5 weeks ago, and ran into a girl that was down there and she went, "You used to work at Starbucks, right?" I was like, "Man, a long time ago." And she's like, "Clark Road?" I was at that one for a while. She goes, "I'm Kat." I was like, "Oh my God." And the first thing I said to her was, "I'm sorry.
I'm not that guy anymore."
And I was like, "I treated you so bad. Like, I was such a jerk. I'm so sorry." And she was like, "No, it's cool. We're all different places in life." And I was like, "Cool. All right." But really, like, I'm real sorry. Like, did not like who I became then.
So corporate starts to become shoes that don't fit.
Yeah. I mean, and by shoes that don't fit, I mean, it got to the point where you get yelled at by customers so much and things like that. And then, you know, you have to be the bad guy and all this. I used to wear a bow tie to work every day while I worked at Starbucks. And part of that was to de-escalate situations. And the other part was then no one would recognize me outside of work.
That's clever.
And I'm like, I'm literally wearing a costume to be here.
This is like the Clark Kent glasses.
I had fake glasses on too. So yeah, it was truly that bow tie, fake glasses, boom. That was my persona. And I didn't like who I became, you know. And so I left there and went into more craft coffee.
So what's that point like? What's the point where you're like, "Hey, wait a minute, this is turning me inside out enough, even though I've had all this success, I'm out of here"? Because a lot of people will just sign up for more punishment, and being ornery and shitty to other people is other people's problem.
I know. Yeah, and I was real fortunate. I had a gentleman named Justin as well, who was my manager at the time. One of the few people I've ever worked with that, like, I would do anything this guy said. Like, true respect, amazing, amazing manager, amazing human being. And he actually told me about a different coffee shop that was opening that's craft coffee. And he's like, "Dude, you should go work there and you need to quit."
So that kind of gave you permission.
Yeah. And, chatted with those people, went into that, started working there, started learning more and more about craft coffee. And this was at like really the start of the boom of craft coffee.
So what year are we talking?
Would have been 2000. Let's see, was it 2014? 2013, 2014?
Okay.
Right around there. And at that time, no, especially in Florida, Florida was a little bit behind in, you know, craft coffee, kind of like we are in, like, you know, upper echelon food and things like that, you know? And you had all these people that thought we're a tourist town, so you can't have true craft coffee here.
Right.
Because you need locals, and the locals know anything. They all want diner coffee because they're all old.
Yeah.
And, you know, we know we're not all old that live here.
No.
And a lot of people ain't moving away anymore.
Not anymore.
And so started working at this shop, and there was that air of, I know more than you, and to a customer. And at that point in time, I had really started diving deep back into learning about importation and learning about the farms, just kind of on my own time, as well as learning more about the science in the shops themselves. And there's just this, like, douchebag feel if someone comes in and goes, oh, well, I like coffee from Colombia. Okay, cool. Well, Colombia is a country, so what region in Colombia do you like your coffee from? You know, and, like, okay, cool. People here don't know that.
Right, or care.
You know, right. That's the same as, like, someone from Colombia coming to the U.S. and going, I like barbecue.
Yeah.
And then someone in the U.S. going, well, do you like Texas barbecue or Kansas barbecue or North Carolina barbecue? And they're all different, right?
Very.
Well, someone that's not from here doesn't know that. And all of a sudden, there was just this air of pretentiousness that was created in these shops with a product we're not growing. All I'm doing is grinding it up and pouring stuff over it and giving it to you.
Right.
Like, I'm not even creating the original product. Why in the world am I, like, the pompous douchebag about this product that someone else did all the hard work for? I'm just the messenger. And so it really kind of, for a while, turned me off of the craft coffee scene. And I immediately started looking, how do I get out of this?
Was that one of the biggest differences you noticed right away?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, you walk into a Starbucks, you're getting sugar in a cup with a little bit of, like, coffee that's burned to a crisp that's 2 years old.
Yeah.
Like, whatever. You know, like, yeah. No one's drinking black coffee there unless you're, like,
right.
60.
Yeah,
plus,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
No offense to any of the 60-plus listeners out there. Yeah. You know?
But nobody's drinking
no
black coffee.
That. Yeah, no. Yeah, no. You want a caramel frappuccino. Like,
yeah.
Whatever. And, you know, at Starbucks, that was my guilty confession anyway. Like, yeah, I'm tasting stuff and I'm dissecting it. But I drank on, like, you know, we all have those bad days and you all got to cope. Like, my coping mechanism was a iced quad venti 4-pump raspberry no whip white mocha.
Damn, son.
It's so gross.
Yeah.
And, like, I hate that I know that order so well and that I remember it, as well as, like, remembering my Starbucks employee number. Like, that's ingrained in your brain.
Yeah. Yes.
Like, I could wish I could make it go away.
Yes. I've got the same with my Sam Ash number. I'll never forget it.
Yep.
I worked there in God knows how long, 15 years.
I looked up the grams of sugar that are in that drink, and it's the same as eating an entire cherry pie. I wish I had just ate cherry pies, like, for however many years I drank that. You know, like, I feel like that's more of a bragging right than drinking that.
Yeah, for real.
But anyway, you know, so it's like, you know, it's getting back to, like, craft coffee. I just noticed this, like, I'm better than you personality.
Yeah.
And I was like, I hate that. I don't want to be better than anybody. I mean, I do want to be better, but I want to, like, be better for myself.
Yeah,
not
exactly.
To put someone down.
Right. That's the better than me yesterday mentality.
Exactly. And that was really when, like, more of the dream of ONA started with moving onto the street.
Okay.
Because I saw myself in, you know, the corporate world becoming a jerk when I was there. And back when I was in telecom, that's in sales. And I saw myself with the idea, if you work, you know, any kind of a job that's sales, there's always loopholes. There's always a way to rig a system. And, like, I'm smart enough to figure it out. So are a lot of other people.
Yeah.
And I remember one day I hinted at, like, if I just do this, my commission's going to be huge. You're like, but that's shady as hell. And that was the day that I quit. and like corporate was the same. I saw myself becoming this jerk for months to people and hated who I was. And I was like, I got to quit and I needed a way out. And then I get into craft coffee and then I realize I don't want to fall into that. I'm better than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so easy to do, you know, and I'm sure I've done it. I think we all have, but I don't want to be that.
Right. That can't be the first foot forward.
No. And so, I mean, for me, that's when becoming a mobile coffee bar, like really kind of became this idea of how can I educate people in Sarasota about craft coffee in a way that's not intimidating. It's not scary. It's an approachable thing. You know, think about like walking into a brand new restaurant and you pull open that door and it's dark inside and maybe no one's at a table. You kind of have that freak out moment.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that restaurant's just undiscovered and their food's awesome, but you're still having that freak out moment of like, I'm in the wrong spot.
Right.
Like, this isn't going to be good.
Exactly.
And I think a coffee shop can be that way for people too. And so, you know, just brainstorming and coming up with ideas. And that's kind of when the first part of ONA started with the mobile bar, where, you know, bringing it out onto a street corner and people would drive by me, you know, a dozen times before anyone would stop. And finally, people started to stop and buy coffee. But no one would just buy a coffee. They'd be like, what are you doing?
Of course.
Cool. That just opens me up to having these stories. And I started working at the time. I wasn't roasting. So I started bringing in coffee from all of these amazing roasters all over the world.
And what was that like? How'd you get yourself going on that? You just straight cold calling?
Honestly, like the best places randomly just mailed me stuff. And so, I mean, I have like my boys over at Cert Coffee in Tulsa, Oklahoma that just mailed my house 3 bags of coffee because they saw it was a mobile coffee bar. And I tasted it and it was great. And then that started that relationship. And they're like two of my best friends in the coffee world.
Very cool.
Now. And, you know, we've only seen each other maybe 6 times ever in real life. But I know if I needed anything, like I literally talked to one of them on the phone an hour ago.
Nice.
In Tulsa, you know? And then that's what let me meet Andy over at Sweet Bloom. That's in Denver, Colorado, who's just an amazing human being. And I mean, these are people that mail me Christmas cards every year. And it's like, you know, just meeting these really cool people. And the reason I was drawn to them also is they all work direct trade. So they're all working with their farmers as well. So they were doing the thing that I wanted to do. So now I finally have the first step of like, I can make coffee. I'm, you know, vicariously working direct trade because I'm serving their coffees.
Right.
Now
you're helping that wheel go around.
Exactly. You know, and so that was kind of really the next transition and step into that.
So how long did you do the cart and just the straight no gatekeeping portion of the show before
4 years.
You opened a brick and mortar?
Yeah, 4 years. Yeah, 4 years of just standing on the side of the road, rain, you know, too much sun, everything else. I mean, from that one spot, I could tell you where the sun rose every month of the entire year and how much direct sun I was going to get. Like, I knew that spot.
Good that was, Lord.
Yeah, Monday through Friday.
4 years, is that longer than you anticipated doing that? Or you went into it with no expectation, I'll do it until the next thing presents itself?
I went into it definitely with no real, like, end game, I guess.
Yeah.
And it was probably about 3 years in. One, that cart's heavy. Like, we all get old. And that cart gets heavier as it gets old.
Yeah.
Because really, people are like, this is what you're going to do the rest of your life? And I'm like, yeah, hell yeah, let's do this.
Yeah.
And you're like, cool, this cart's 500 pounds.
Exactly.
My legs hurt.
Exactly.
You know? Like, so I think there's a natural progression of, like, you can't do that your whole life. From then, I also started meeting some really cool people that became, like, my first employees. Was one of my first employees. Her name was Allison. And then my next one, his name was Rob. And they both just had awful jobs. They both loved coffee. Allison had already been in coffee, but had moved to Sarasota and went into being a social worker and hated it.
Imagine that.
Obviously, very tough job.
Yeah, exactly.
Rob was a marine biologist and hated it and ran like fish farms and like all this other stuff. And his shoes would get burned through with caustic, you know, chemicals, like,
oh,
and all that stuff, right? and still loved that, but wanted out. And I couldn't tell him anywhere to even go work in coffee. And so it kind of became my next thought was, if I stay small, I can't help anyone else.
Small as in the cart.
The cart, right. So if I stay as cart size, I can't help a single employee get out of what they want to do and actually get into coffee. Or a single person, I should say, get out of what they're doing and into coffee. And there wasn't any coffee as a career options in Sarasota.
Right.
You know, and so that kind of led me to my first store. But before even that first store, I really had to come up with the idea of the fact, do I want to stay as a mom and pop and open one store? Or do I want to create a company and actually make something that people could eventually maybe retire from or have a career in? And that was my decision then, was that's what I needed to do.
Before store one.
Before store one. So store one was opened with the idea and the premise, more stores to come, roastery to come. And those, and I needed to figure out the orders of those things. But that was the whole intentionality of going from cart to store.
What do you think about your background or your personality led you to be that ambitious out of the gate without, you know, trying to act like flying low was a good idea?
I don't sleep, so I think that helps. it's a dumb hereditary thing. Thanks, Mom. Love you. But, you know, 3 hours of sleep a night's like a... It's pretty solid. It's a good night for me. And so I think I'm just naturally really driven. And I'm also just a real big softy. And I feel like there's a lot of things in my life I've done that are wrong. And I think sometimes you get driven to like really try to make things right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the best ways to do that is really create a career for even other people. And create a dream for other people. So even if they're not with me, I mean, I just lost one of the best managers I've ever had. Last week was her last week. It sucks. You know, she's with me 2.5 years, almost 3. And she left to go to another place to like spread her wings. And I really hope it works out.
Right.
You know, and
I guess that's the double-edged sword of being able to nurture quality people.
Yeah, as all of a sudden now other people want to employ your people, you know, and you can't hold it against them.
No.
Like, they need to grow too. And, you know, I mean, she started with me when she had just turned 18. And I'm kind of like the first, you know, quote unquote, big adult job.
Right.
You know, so go do it. Go spread your wings. Figure out what you really like to do, you know, if this isn't it. But if this is it, cool. Like, let's stick around. Let's make you a career and make you a job. And I guess that's the hardest part of the whole thing right now is now we're at this point, you know, not to jump ahead, but now I'm at this point where I have a company with a couple stores and the roastery and everything else. Now it's like wrangling all that stuff in to a defined point for an individual person. And that's a whole different world than just, hey, here's your schedule for the week.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, this is beyond taking care of your houseplant now. This is you growing your own.
Right. Yeah.
So do you think that, or I guess I should say it's inevitable that your history played into some of your ambition to go or to have these thoughts, I'm going to go bigger than one store right away because you had the experience at Starbucks and all these other things. So did it not seem like that tall of a mountain for you? Did it seem like doable before you put the first foot forward? Was that really your mentality?
I have an Achilles heel, I would say, of I don't really think there's anything I can't do. And that has definitely bit me in the butt a few times.
That's the gift and the curse of that one.
You know, where I've invested in things that are wrong and I've lost it all, or I've trusted in wrong people or trusted in myself when I shouldn't have or whatever, you know. But I think at times everyone has that daunting moment, whether they say they do or not.
You're right.
But it's so fleeting for me where I can have that moment and then I'll just be like, all right, cool. If I think about this, then I'm going to fail. So what do I need to do now? And so you got to keep moving. I mean, a year ago, I took on, a little over a year ago now, I guess, I took on a partner and it did not go well. And then I had to buy him out. I mean, that put me, based on my calculations, probably 3 years behind my goals at minimum. That sucks.
Yeah, well.
And it ain't no one's fault but mine.
Right.
You know, but then I could dwell there, or I can be like, all right, I'm 3 years behind goals, so let me push a little bit harder and start trying to make that so I'm only a year and a half behind my goals.
So does a part of those types of kicks in the ass almost turn out to be kind of exciting?
That one, nah, it still sucks. Okay. I mean, maybe like a year and a half from now it'll be great. Nah, it still sucks. My mom's really good at reminding me of one of her favorite people in the world and a quote that he said, which is, everyone needs a good failure.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's Walt Disney saying that right after he had lost everything. And it's right. I mean, I think I've had more than one, so I feel like I'm good for a while, you know? At least that'd be really cool if that's the case.
Take a break from the learning experiences for just a minute and use the knowledge.
Yeah, that'd be real cool. But yeah, I mean, everyone does. We all need that moment where you really believe in a thing and then it screws you over so hard.
Yeah.
And then you realize, boy, this wasn't the right move. Let me recenter myself, figure it back out, and then move on.
And that's the trick.
Yeah.
So talk to me about the points where that, where you've had that going in the good direction, where store one becomes store two, you add the roastery. How do you get from the inspiration to try to make a home for other people that have a passion like you to the point where you're growing that home?
Sure. So, I mean, store two was an interesting choice because I didn't know whether to do the roastery first or the store first, or a second store first.
What's the benefit of the roastery?
So a couple different things. COVID, I think, taught all of us pretty big lessons, right? We were going to go store roaster. So only one store, one roastery. The nice thing with the roastery is it lets me have more buying power with my farmers.
Mm.
So for instance, I have a lot coming in here in the next month that is a Peruvian lot that is phenomenal. I'm so excited about it. That lot produced 25 bags of coffee. That's it. We own all of it. So we are the only place in the world that you will ever be able to get this coffee.
That seems like a remarkably small amount.
Correct. And if we had stayed even smaller, I couldn't buy all 25 bags.
Ah.
So now that farmer, that producer, has to find someone else to buy those other bags. But let's say I could buy, you know, 20. How in the world are they going to sell five bags of coffee?
Right.
So that sucks for them, you know. And so the other big thing that I noticed with COVID was I had my friends at Cirque. They had expanded to stores. But the way that they got hit by COVID was really unique and very similar to a lot of other people where they had to lay off 22 people. Well, Florida was a weird anomaly during COVID where I could still stay open. The only people that Cirque was roasting coffee for during COVID was me.
Damn.
That's it. Like, that's it.
So Florida's policies had reaching beyond our borders.
Right. It let them keep the few people that they had on.
Wow.
Because we were their only wholesale account.
Dang.
Yeah, excuse me. And so that's when I noticed that if I open a second store instead of a roastery, if something like COVID hits again and Florida stays Florida, as it does,
we only get to be more Florida.
Both of those stores stay open. And if both those stores stay open, I don't lay a single person off and I'm self-sufficient because of my roastery. So I can roast for my stores alone. And that would make enough revenue to keep all those people employed. Wouldn't make any profit, but we can at least be at break even until the world goes back to whatever normality is.
Right.
So that's when I shifted from going straight from a roastery to the second store, then a roastery. That was like the big shift. But at the same time, I'm still learning, you know, and I think this is the way I'm trying to build this. I don't know anyone else that's done it this way. And a lot of times, you know, people have a couple partners that are in coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas for me, like, I have one partner, but he does real estate. Like, that dude ain't jumping behind the bar to help me make drinks. And there's nothing wrong with that. Like, that's why we're good in business
together. I was going to say that can be beneficial.
Absolutely. Like, get out of my kitchen. Yeah. You know, it's that whole style.
Exactly.
But it also means that, like, when it comes to a lot of other things, it falls on me, you know? And so, you know, just really trying to focus and bring that new store up and, you know, the opportunity in Waterside out in Lakewood Ranch. It's COVID. They're not leasing anything to anybody. That stuff had barely had ground broken, you know, because at the time, like, contractors and stuff are having to wear a mask while laying brick. Like, no one's going to work, you know? And so we got that opportunity and got a really good deal in negotiating and everything else. And I really thought that would be a great area and seeing long game.
Right.
Because, like we've always said, even with our spot downtown, even with the mobile bar, everything else, our mission as a coffee company and coffee shop is our community and then to the community of our farmers. That's always our mission. I will take a tourist money all day long, but they are not the thing that keep my lights on.
Which is counterintuitive to most things around here.
Correct. Because if you are just that, then you can close the whole month of September and you can go on your little vacation. You can do whatever you want. Whereas, like, we're open. I mean, the only days that we close is Thanksgiving and Christmas. That's it. Other than that, we're here. And we're here for the local community. And so I felt like Lakewood Ranch was such a growing, like, new community that we would have that, you know, immediate local person. It's not really a touristy area. And that's sustainable all year round.
Right.
You know, so that was kind of the idea with the next store as being out there.
So how far between the second store and the roastery? What's the gap there?
For timeline?
Yeah.
I was about 7 miles. Timeline, 2 years.
Okay. So that put that back a little bit.
Yeah, it was supposed to open 1 year and then went through that whole partnership thing. And so that knocked that back even a year before it even opened. So, I mean, I was a year into my lease before I ever turned on my roaster.
Dang.
Yeah, it sucks.
So I want to circle back. What's the big benefits of having your own roastery besides it increases your ability to have more buying power because you've got two stores and you can take everything under one roof? How does it change with the product that you receive and the product that you're then delivering end game?
Boy, so much. I mean, it's really cool because we still work with other multi-roasters.
What does that mean?
So multi-roaster shops and things like that are shops that serve not just their own coffee, but will also serve other people's coffees.
Okay.
And we work with other roasters still as well. So like Andy at Sweet Bloom, him and I are like chatting constantly about a different farm that he'll bring in their stuff and then we'll bring in their stuff.
Okay.
And so we can now split farms. And so he'll, you know, roast it his way, I'll roast it my way. And we have like really cool collaboration almost type of things. That also being said, it sets us up to where next year we're actually going to start bringing these producers from other countries here to Sarasota because we can do a multi-stop with them. So like maybe I'll fly them to Sarasota and then Andy at Sweet Bloom will fly them from Sarasota to Colorado. And so that way all of our customers get to meet these actual people that are growing their coffees and just really expanding from not just our community to our community meeting the community that is growing what they're actually drinking. And that's one of the cool things that we can do because of the roastery. You know, that also being said, it lets me have these communications and these talks with like my good friend Rafael. Rafael owns Vinhal Estates, which is his family. He's the 9th generation farmer there.
That's wild.
In Brazil. Last year he had this really dope coffee that's so crazy. He like co-fermented it on starfruit and lemongrass as the cherry itself was being fermented off of the coffee bean. And so when you drink it and you grind it and you roast it and all this other stuff, like you get wild, like star fruit and tropical fruit. And it's like weirdly chewing on like Laffy Taffy but it's just black coffee. Like it's crazy stuff that'll like blow your mind. Well, he only made 2 bags of that. So it was only 300 pounds in existence of that last year, which meant that that was selling for like $14 a pound.
Dang.
That's crazy. Yeah, that means that my retail price per cup would have to be like $11 to $12 a cup, like for you to drink black coffee.
Right.
But because we worked with them and I love the coffee so much that this harvest season, I was like, dude, I'll buy 10 bags of this if you can help me like with some price and stuff, because now he's producing more of it.
I was going to say that helps him inherently. Right. Yeah.
So now we can get that price down to where it's more attainable for our customers, but he's still making an actual living. And he can do these cool experimental things without the worry of, is this garbage? Like, is anyone going to buy this? And now we're buying forward, which means that we're buying these lots before they ever ship to the U.S. That way the farmers have the security.
And that's a big shift from the way the coffee game was played in the not that distant past, correct?
Correct, yeah. So originally, when you look at like a lot of the larger corporations, you know, your Dunkin's, your Starbucks, Nestle, who owns everything.
Yeah, from water to cocoa all over the planet.
Yeah. I mean, so many companies that you're drinking their coffee are owned by Nestle. Most people don't know. You know, and so you'd have those big boys go into Colombia as a country, and they would go up to a coffee mill, which the mill is where all the farmers take their coffees for processing. And they would just go, cool, what's your oldest coffee and your cheapest stuff here? Cool, now give me a discount on top of that. I'll buy all of last year's lots.
And all producers had to go to these centralized mills. This was always some kind of middleman racket,
right,
yeah?
Right.
Okay, okay.
And also, then you'd have to go through a distributor. Like, I can't, even though, like, I know Rafael, I still can't buy from Rafael because of U.S. import laws.
Oh.
I have to buy through a distributor.
Oh.
Which that's kind of a really cool, like, other story now that's, like, become part of my life. That's very, very neat, and we can get into that, too. But, like,
sure.
So then, essentially, what was happening, to go back to that, all these places were buying coffee like you and I would buy stock. So if Colombia had a really bad year, that means that that coffee would really suffer. Let's say they got too much rain or not enough rain, right? So now your coffee is grading lower on a point scale. If it grades lower, then the price is lower. So let's buy all of it. Mm. And they would buy just containers and containers and containers of lower grade coffee. And then they would put in giant warehouses, and then they would just roast it as needed over the years.
Mm.
Well, the problems with that is you have toxicities, you have molds, you have a rat running through the warehouse. You know, like all
this stuff. You're
still
dealing with an organic product.
Right. And, you know, if you roast it dark enough and burn it enough, you're not going to taste any of that imperfections.
This is the well-done cheap steak.
It's not just that. It's what the beer world turned into, where
fermenting it off rice, dude, and corn and every other cheap-ass
exactly.
ingredient.
Yeah. Or if you don't know how to make a beer and you add enough hops,
well, it tastes like something.
Tastes like something.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean,
good
it's,
point.
It's the exact same thing, you know? And so that's what these companies were. I mean, it's the original Italian dark roast. People don't realize that Italy just couldn't get coffee for a while. And so they started dark roasting stuff for espresso because it was old.
Ah.
Like,
well,
it
that
didn't
makes
have any
sense,
flavor.
I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, that's why they do that. You know, now they have good coffee and stuff. But, like, back in the day, that's what it was.
Right.
And, you know, it's why we put stuff in cans, you know, and now that we have those channels, we can actually change that culture and that mindset. So the stuff that we're getting in is from, you know, this year's harvest. It's not sitting in massive warehouses for years on years. You're inspecting these products. You know, I mean, I'm literally double checking the amount of water within the bean of every lot to make sure that it's within 11 to 13% water core. So that way I know that it hasn't sat for too long and that it's not oversaturated. Like, that's the chemistry part that, like, I do, you know.
Because what's the implication of that? If it's too little moisture, it doesn't roast right. If it's too much moisture, it doesn't roast right. I mean, this is...
Right. Also, too little moisture, how long has this actually been sitting? You didn't mail me my actual product.
Ah.
So that's why knowing your importer is so important. And we're very fortunate right now. We work specifically with two importers. And they also know all the farms I work with. One of them is in Clearwater. Like, I'm driving up there tomorrow to pick up green coffee that he brought in from Guatemala. Like, it's right there. So that goes, you know, Guatemala, Clearwater, the back bed of my truck, my roastery.
Love like, that.
Yeah, you know, and the cool thing with that too is for especially Central and South American farmers, you know how cheap it is to fly to Tampa?
Right.
It's like, dude, we bring these guys up and have coffee with them. You know, one of my favorite coffees is the Salado Blanco, which is a Colombian from Huila. Like, the producer there named Sarah was just in Tampa, you know, 2 weeks before the hurricanes and just sipping on some coffee, you know. And
so being able to tighten up from the producer to the end seller has really increased not only the efficiency, but the quality.
Yeah, exactly. And El Grano is a Swedish company that we started working with that essentially is a website. Like, that's it. And so I can go on there and they're linking me directly to every farmer now. So instead of me trying to like hunt around, now I can buy stuff from Raphael right there. And let's say there's some dude in like, you know, Colorado that also wants to buy Raphael stuff. Now we can split a container.
Oh.
So then Raphael doesn't have to discount his product.
Right. Because he's only got
shipping.
Yeah.
And so smart. It's not like we're not paying our farmers, but now we're able to cut the non-human cost, the shipping right. cost down and actually still pay our farmers.
Right. You so can that's shift the expenditure.
Part. Yep.
Smart.
Yeah. So that's kind of been the different change on that. But it also requires the insane amount of scheduling. Like, I've bought a bunch of stuff from Raphael. I don't get that till January. So I can't roast it tomorrow. You know, like, right. I can't even really, like, I get excited about it, and I've already had the samples. That stuff doesn't go into a container till January.
It's like the pre-order curse.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Now you got to get tickets for a concert 2 years in advance, basically.
I know. Ah, Deftones curse you. Sold out in an hour and a half.
Of course.
Bunch of bastards.
Of course. So, how do you get to the point where... You were explaining to me a little bit earlier now that craft coffee, you kind of got to go one of two ways to be viable. And mm-hmm. it seems like paying attention to the nuance, crossing the T's and dotting the I's, this is the channel that you've clearly taken and you've been on since you were five and didn't know it.
Yeah.
So talk to me a little bit about the landscape of what retailing coffee is like, especially now that you've gotten the pieces of the puzzle together where you can buy with... more precision, you can roast your own coffee, you can deliver the product that you're after, you're starting to do these things, but there's still this fork in the road for viability as this market goes forward, irrespective of what you do.
Right.
How do you see that working right now for you and in general?
It is an insane spider web for me to figure out. It is, yeah. Yeah, you know, we talked about those living alive moments, and it's like, 90% of the time when I'm sitting on my patio, like watching the sunset at my house, 90% of the time, maybe 98% of the time, I'm thinking in my head, what is my next step on this?
Right.
And yeah, that 2% of the time, they're like, I had a really great birthday with my girlfriend. That was cool. You know, and then you're like, yeah. And then you're right back to like,
of course.
All right, let me figure this out. And, you know, so it's like doing that. There are so many ways to do it, and none of it's easy, and none of it's perfect, and none of it's right, and none of it's wrong. And that's really what, you know, we're navigating right now. And I brought in another gentleman to help me do that, who's my warehouse manager and wholesale manager, because he used to be a food scientist in Ohio. And, you know, he also has a great palate, but he's never worked in coffee. So, you know, he can also sell stuff, but he's never sold to a coffee shop.
Right.
And that's a different world.
There's some universal things, but.
Yeah. But like if I write an email that sounds formal and I give that to a coffee shop, they're like, all right, who is this capitalistic prick? You know, like, whereas like, you're like, hey dude, you want some coffee? And they're like, dope. Awesome. You yeah. know, like that's the world that we're in.
Yeah.
Like,
true.
You know,
true.
I got a collared shirt on because I was going to be here today. If I walk into a coffee shop with a collared shirt on and go to like. Sell them coffee, I'm like a corporate dude.
I was
and
gonna
that's
say,
not cool.
That's sus instant.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so, you know, there's that world to navigate to. And like, it's always being genuine to yourself, too, and everything
else. Of course,
else.
Of course.
And it's being genuine to yourself, but figuring out a way to keep the lights on. It's what my mom told me as a young kid. Figure out what you love to do, and then figure out a way to make money doing it so you can live happy.
Amen to that.
And so... Yeah, is the next step me selling to a grocery store? Could be. But then I got to buy containers for myself because that's the only way I'm going to get the coffee cheap enough that it can be in a grocery store.
Right.
And I make more than $1 a bag.
And yeah, and then you're talking about having to stray away from some of the nuanced things like the starfruit right. and lemongrass that make it special.
Exactly. So is it that or is my next chapter trying to go more national on online subscriptions where we're mailing coffee out to people?
Of course.
You know, so there's that aspect. Or is it only going after other cafes to serve my coffee? And the correct answer is it's all of them, which is so daunting. because none of them are going to hit right now. And you have to think of it like making a parlay bet. All right, I think the Chiefs are going to win the AFC West. I think the, you know, Dodgers are going to win the World Series. I think this is going to happen. I think this is going to happen.
Right.
You may hit on one or two of them, but you're not going to hit on all of them. Very rarely are you ever going to hit on all of them.
Exactly.
And so it's the same thing for me. Like right now I have about four different channels of directions forward that I'm pursuing. And some of them are a little bit weirder than I thought would be a thing. But I'm all right with weird.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And then some of them are things I've dreamed about for years. And I'm really hoping this January I can put into action. But the one that I dream about for years is the one that's going to be like, you make $5 on it.
Of course.
You know,
but
like,
it's
that's
the most rewarding
one.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And so you have to have that mix of the two. And I'll be the first to say that if you had asked me that question a year ago, my answer would be totally different. But I've actually realized that, one, I'm wrong, and that's okay to say and grow
from.
That's
the powerful realization when you're running a business right there.
Yep. So, and, you know, I don't say that lightly and I don't say that easily, but definitely, like, I was wrong on a couple of my aspects that I thought would be a really, like, a thing. And, you know, there's, like I said, there's different ways to keep the lights on and there's different ways to stick to who you truly are. But one of the main missions of ONA is coffee is a humble beverage and it should be served as such.
Because it's the ritual it facilitates where the value really is.
Right. I serve you bean water that someone else grew. I'm just adding water. So I got to stick to that humility and that mindset when I'm serving other people or when I'm working with my staff or when I'm growing a company. And if you don't have that mindset, you'll never admit that you're wrong and you'll never learn from it.
Powerful.
And that's when you fall apart. Or you have that mindset and you grow beyond what even you could possibly think of growing in.
And that's the way it works. And I imagine when we have a conversation a couple of years from now, we'll be talking about how that happened.
Hope so. Yeah.
So I normally like to get you out of here on something fun, and I'm going to do that. But I got to ask you something loaded first.
Fire.
This is a question that I spent the first 43 years of my life never drinking coffee at all. I drank one cappuccino when I was like 17 growing up in Wisconsin because it was cold and I was freezing and sure. I got sick. And when I drink caffeine, there's no other way I can put this. I get high as a kite.
Sure.
And I dated a woman for a long time who was an avid coffee drinker. Whenever I said coffee got me high, this was a point of contention that I phrased it this way. And this is the way I looked at it. But this was the only sense that I could liken it to.
Yeah, totally.
So when you hear the phrase or when someone espouses the statistic that caffeine is the most widely used drug in the world, what does that make you think, being that obviously your world doesn't, it's not
like... Oh, I'm
like
a legal drug dealer.
Yeah.
Like 100%. Like, yeah. Yeah, I'm a absolute legal drug dealer, for sure.
Yeah. Do you see that smacks of reality? Obviously, yes.
I think yes and no. I think that there are way worse things to be addicted to.
Oh, of course. Oh, no question about that.
No, but I think every person's so totally different.
Yeah.
I mean, I literally just spent, you know, the past day, because also I'm at the point in life where I'm not going to drink bad coffee.
Why would you?
People ask me that question of like, well, if you don't have your coffee around, you know, where, like, what do you do to make bad coffee good?
Wait.
I don't drink it.
Yeah.
Like, I'll get like an orange juice. And so that always brings up the thing of like, I don't drink soda anymore either, really. Like maybe one every other month or something, right? So I don't drink that. I don't like tea. I think tea is basically just like salad water. Stupid. Get your leaves out of my cup.
Yeah.
Dumb.
It's a different lane.
Hate it.
For sure.
Hate it.
For sure.
And like, obviously we sell it. So, you know, whatever. Still come to ONA and get your tea. It's very good.
Yeah.
No, get your salad juice. Like, hate it. And so for me, like yesterday I was out of town. I didn't drink coffee. I didn't have headaches. I was fine.
That was going to be my next question.
No. I mean, I I mean, everyone laughs because I went on, I took my first vacation like 2 years right before Helene, like slash during Helene, because why not go on a cruise?
Yeah, sure.
Awesome. But, you know, like I bring my own coffee setup if I go. Like I'm not drinking cruise ship coffee. That stuff's garbage.
Oh, Christ, yeah.
But I drank maybe one cup in the morning that's 8 ounces. And that was it. And, you know, and it's I only did that more for the ritual of me getting up in the morning.
Yeah.
Than I did for caffeine. So caffeine doesn't really affect me. Now, if I eat a cookie, I'm freaking wired because I cut a lot of sugar out a long time ago. And so now, like, I'm a sugar junkie. So you give me, like, cake or something, and then that's when I'm high.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, like I said, so I think everyone's affected differently. I think that people that are drinking, you know, Dunkin' or Starbucks, they're not caffeine addicts. They're sugar addicts.
Yeah, yeah.
Period. Like, yeah. I worked in that. I know the sugar. You're a sugar addict.
Well, that was my gateway into coffee because now for the last year and a half, I now drink coffee, but my gateway was what I call hot caramel water.
Yep.
Because it was just sugar water.
It's just sugar water.
Yeah.
It's sugar water.
So.
So, I mean, I think, you know, everyone has a vice. Do I get worried morally that I serve people?
Nah.
Nah. I mean, I did cut one guy off once. But that's because we were catering an event at a brewery and the dude ordered a flat white, which is, you know, milk, 2 shots of espresso. It's an 8 ounce size. He gave me a 20. He was very drunk and then walked away. So cool. Thank you for the $15 tip.
Yeah.
Came back 5 minutes later, got another one, gave me another 20, walked away. On his fourth one, I was like, dude, I got to cut you off. He's like, I can handle the caffeine. I was like, nah, dude, you're going to go broke.
Yeah.
You're giving me a ton of money.
And plus, that is super hard on your body.
So hard on your body. You have no recollection of this tomorrow. Like, and I'm not going to be the guy that takes advantage of you. So you're cut off. That's the only time I've cut someone off of caffeine.
Fair enough.
So
I guess there's got to be one.
Right. And honestly, the cool thing with us is, you know, not to say it's cleaner, but in a way it is. Like our coffee beans are fresher. They're going to hit you, as far as the caffeine goes, it'll hit you a little bit quicker, but like you're not going to have that drop off. So you're not going to need a lot more.
Well, it is it, not to liken it to other drugs, but the quality of the source material matters for the experience.
It really does.
And I think that's something that people, because they don't always make the connection that, you know, coffee is a drug or it is one of these things mm-hmm. that these beans are not cut from the same cloth.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I definitely appreciate you sharing that because I think that the quality over quantity thing is a good route to go no matter what it is.
Absolutely.
We're getting into because that's where the real experience you're after lies.
And honestly, know your drink. Like for people that are, you know, maybe more sensitive to caffeine, everyone's like, oh, I can't do espresso. A 12-ounce cup of coffee and a 2-ounce shot of espresso are the exact same amount of caffeine.
Right.
So if you're getting a latte or you're getting a 12-ounce coffee, it's the same. You know, there's no like, oh, man, I really need that espresso because I'm tired. It's the same. If, like, you're sensitive to caffeine, don't drink cold brew. Like, cold brew is, like, king in Florida. It's hot. Cold brew is the only way that I'm going to feel caffeine.
Yeah? Why is that? What's the difference
it's
in that?
It's so much caffeine.
Yeah?
Like, compared to, like, a cup of coffee. Yeah, it's 2.5 times. So it obviously matters how you brew your cold brew and how you make it.
Right.
But like the way that we make ours, it's 2.5 times the amount of caffeine as a cup of coffee.
Shit.
Yeah. So if you're not ready for that,
you're gonna drink it. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
All right. Well, now we'll get you out of here on something fun. We got through the loaded one. If you could have a cup of coffee with anyone, living or dead, who is it and where are you having it?
That's such a weird question. I mean, because you have like the sentimental thing.
Of course.
So, you know, if I'm permitted, I'd give two answers to that.
Sure. We don't do rules.
Awesome. So first, I would have one cup of coffee with my grandfather at his kitchen table in Kansas City, Missouri, in Gladstone.
Hell yes.
Like, that's where it started. I'd give anything to have one more cup with him.
Awesome. You know,
he passed away about 6 years ago now. And yeah,
so he got to see some of this come to fruition.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Very cool.
So that would be the number one. If I could have one more cup, it'd be that. The non-sentimental one. I've always been a big World War II buff.
Yeah.
And my grandfather fought in the war. You know, what's the old common joke for guys? Once you hit 30, you have to either get into like smoking barbecue, or learning about a war.
Yes.
You know, and yeah. It's like, so I got 10 years under my belt of like really diving into World War II, even though I was really into it before as well. But I really think it'd be cool to have a cup of coffee with Winston Churchill.
Nice.
I don't know. He's always like fascinated me, and he's just such a bull of a human being.
Good answer.
Easily intimidated, but I feel like that might even be like an intimidating like time to drink coffee.
Hell yeah.
But at the same time, I really want to pick his brain on why he did some of the stuff he did and like ideas and all that kind of stuff.
And over a cup of coffee is a good place to have those conversations.
Best place to have those conversations.
Awesome. Well, Justin, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you coming down. Fourth time is the charm. And whenever you get another store open or a next thing going, you're always welcome here. You're Kay, the family, and we can't tell you how much we appreciate you being here and sharing, man.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, brother.